Any parents that have children ages 4 to 7, if you wish, you can dismiss them to Stepping Stones. We are in the middle of our summer sermon series going through the book of Hebrews. Just a couple of thoughts before we actually get into it. First one is that it's so easy for us as we read the Bible to automatically say, all right, how does this apply to me and my situation, and try to directly connect it. And to forget that the book of Hebrews is called Hebrews because it was written to Jews. It was written to Jewish Christians, and it was written to other Jews scattered throughout the Roman Empire who had heard about Jesus but did not think yet that he was the Messiah. And so as you read through the book of Hebrews, you see all these references back to the Old Testament. And you see the writer of Hebrews making a very bold claim. Now, might not seem that bold to you and I because you've grown up in the church, you've heard it. But for people back then, it was very bold. Because you see, almost everybody had heard of Jesus. There had been many men, not just Jesus, who had claimed to be the Messiah, or somebody else pointed at them and said, I think he's the Messiah. Those men ended up dying. Well, so did Jesus. But none of those other guys did the kind of miracles that Jesus did. Healing and feeding, and nobody spoke like he did either. Yet in the end, for many of the Jews, they said, well, maybe he was a prophet, but he ended up dying anyway. And the writer of Hebrews is trying to build a case and help the people see, and he helped them see it by pointing back to the Old Testament again and again. Yes, Jesus is the Messiah. He is God's Messiah. More than that, he is the exact image of God. And he had to die. And so he's building this case that Jesus not only was working on our behalf, not only is an intercessor, mediator between us and God, but he himself was the sacrifice that was needed. God gave the Jews, through Moses, the Old Testament ceremonial law. And that ceremonial law told them how to worship and what sacrifices to make and all these things. And when he's making the case, do you see the dots? God has placed the dots all the way from Old Testament to Jesus, and they connect. Yes, Jesus died. He had to die. But the other thing to remember is this. The letter was written to real people, teaching them God's truth, reminding them of God's truth that they had been taught. And this was truth that they needed for their life every day. Not just for theological study, not just for guys who not only have dust on their books, but dust on their shoulders because they sit so long in their chairs studying and reading, but for people like you and I in all of the things that we do. Well, last week we saw in the scriptures that we were challenged. The writer said, and if you can imagine him pointing his fingers, are you spiritually dull of hearing? Do you know God, have a relationship with God, yet you've been distracted and you've not been listening? Or are you aware, are you part of the church coming, and so you see all the good that God is doing and you're taking in all the God that gives, but you're ignoring him and living life the way you want to live? Or, third, are you growing spiritually? So the writer gives that challenge. And at the end of those verses, he doesn't leave you kind of like, you know, right in your face. After giving the challenge, he also encourages them. In Hebrews 6, verses 11 and 12, he says, and we desire each of you, each one of you, to show the same earnestness, to have the full assurance of hope, until the end. Now we're going to see at the end of the sermon why it is that we need that assurance and need that hope. But here he says, well, I want you to have that full assurance of hope until the end so that you may not be sluggish, but be imitators of those who through faith and patience inherit the promises. God wants us here today to have the full assurance of his love for us so that we can respond fully to his love for us. And notice that word, imitators. Did the slide go up yet? All right, go ahead and stick that slide up there, that first one. Unless, there we are. See, in middle of verse 12, imitators. God says he's working in the lives of all Christians. So every one of us can look at other Christians, and we can see how God is working in their lives. And when we talk with them, they'll say, oh, yes, I want to love God, and I'm working to try to follow him. I'm not doing it perfectly. But we can see God working in their lives. And he says, see those other people around you that are following God and listening and responding to God's love? Imitate them. And as you do, somebody else can imitate you. But then he keys on that last word there, promises. And he transitions then into pulling from that word for his next thought, which is our scripture for today. We're going to read it together. Remain seated. Let's read together Hebrews 6, verses 13 to 20. There we go. Let's read together. For when God made a promise to Abraham, since he had no one greater by whom to swear, he swore by himself, saying, surely I will bless you and multiply you. And thus Abraham, having waited patiently, obtained the promise. For people swear by something greater than themselves, and all their disputes, an oath is final for confirmation. So when God desired to show more convincingly to the heirs of the promise the unchangeable character of his purpose, he guaranteed it with an oath, so that by two unchangeable things in which it is impossible for God to lie, we who have fled for refuge might have strong encouragement to hold fast to the hope set before us. We have this as a sure and steadfast anchor of the soul, a hope that enters into the inner place behind the curtain, where Jesus has gone as a forerunner on our behalf, having become a high priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. So in verse 13, the writer, remember he's writing to Jews, he uses Abraham as an example, because he knows that to the Jews, Abraham is one of their heroes. And he says, God made a promise to Abraham, and God swore an oath to confirm the promise. And it's not mentioned here in the text, but if you know the account of Abraham, you know that in Genesis, God also made a covenant with Abraham. And all three of these things are related. A promise, an oath, and a covenant. They're all commitments. Now, normally when you think of God's promise to Abraham, you think of the promise for him to have a son. And God gave him a son. But actually, God's promise to Abraham had a few parts. So let's take a minute and look at it. Genesis 12, verses 1, 2, and 3. Now the Lord said to Abram, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. That land was then called the land of Canaan. Today we call it Israel. And I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. So there's several parts here. God says first, I will make you into a great nation. Well, for that to happen, he has to have a son. And he does. Then he says, I will bless you. It's not because Abraham sneezed. That's usually how we use the word. In the Bible, when you talk about bless, most often he's talking about doing good. God says to Abraham, I will do good to you. And he did. He says, I will make your name great. And he has. Even today, the name of Abraham from the Old Testament is still known. He says, you will be a blessing to others. That's what he's thinking of, to others. And then he promises protection when he says, I'll bless those who bless you, curse those who curse you. I'm going to protect you. And if you know the account, God did protect Abraham in some very dramatic ways, in fact. Protected his wife after being taken when Abraham was trying to protect his own skin. But then the last one, in you God said, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Now, God kept all those parts. But as you read the Bible, what we find out is that that last part wasn't just to Abraham, but it was also to us. That through Abraham, all the families of the earth will be blessed, and that blessing came through Jesus. Well, the writer says, you all know about this promise. He's writing to Jews. You know about this promise that God made to Abraham. And then in verse 15, he says, and Abraham, having patiently waited. Now, the writer is not whitewashing Abraham. He knows that Abraham was not always patient. He wasn't. The writer's focusing on the fact Abraham persevered. Okay, he kept at it. And he had to, because God made him wait 25 years for that promised son. And Abraham did, even though he wavered at times, he did continue to trust God, and he received God's blessing and his protection. And the point I think the writer is making is God made a promise and God kept it. The implication, God makes promises to you and me, he's going to keep it as well. And then the writer talks about oaths in kind of a general sense. He says in verse 16, men swear by something greater than themselves as a way of affirming that they are speaking the truth. Good example of that kind of an oath today is when you testify in court. If you've ever testified in court, you know that, and I think they still do this, they have the Bible and they have you put your hand on the Bible and you raise the other hand and you take an oath. You swear that you're going to tell the truth. And there's also the unstated implication, and there are consequences if you don't. But it's a way of saying, I am speaking the truth. Now, in Jesus' day, this kind of affirming was fairly common, it seems. In fact, Jesus commented about the debate, a debate that was going on in his day. In their day, Jews, if they wanted to swear an oath to confirm, I am really speaking the truth, I want you to know I'm really speaking the truth, they would often swear by the temple. But then some said, well, I think if I swear by the gold in the temple, I'm actually making a stronger affirmation that I'm speaking the truth. And Jesus kind of put a nix on it. But you see God's statement to us about oaths in the book of James, James 5, verse 12. But above all, my brothers, do not swear either by heaven or earth or by any other oath, but let your yes be yes and your no be no, so that you may not fall under condemnation. God wants us to be known as honest people, people who have integrity, because he is honest, he's truthful, he has integrity, which means that all of us should, every one of us should be a man or a woman of our word. That should be all that's needed as we speak. And that's going to come into play in a few minutes as we come back to Hebrews 6 and see why it is that God swore an oath after he made the promise. Well, let's just pause here for a second. We're going to get into chapter 7 today, because we're trying to make our way all the way through. And remember that the writer is writing to Jews who have grown up being taught the ceremonial law. And so in some sense, he's not so much unteaching as helping them to see what they hadn't seen before. Have you ever seen a picture or a puzzle and you're looking at it and you're thinking, I can't figure out what it's supposed to be. And you're standing there, and then all of a sudden, it clicks, and you see the picture. Well, that's what the writer is trying to get the people of these Jews, Jewish Christians and other Jews, to see as they look at the Old Testament ceremonial law. Jesus is there. He wants them to see that. So, in Hebrews 7, verses 18 and 19, the writer says, on the one hand, a former commandment is set aside because of its weakness and uselessness. Very interesting words he uses there. For the law made nothing perfect. But on the other hand, a better hope is introduced through which we draw near to God. Now, I believe that former commandment refers to the Old Testament ceremonial law, including the sacrifices. when God used Moses to bring the people of Israel out of Egypt, crossed the Red Sea, into the wilderness, brought them to Mount Sinai, gave them the Ten Commandments, he then called Moses up and he talked to him for 40 days. And part of what he was doing during that time was giving Moses all the ceremonial law. He said, here's how you as a people will worship me. You're going to build a tabernacle, and he told him exactly how to build it. You're going to have these kinds of sacrifices and only these kinds of sacrifices. The sons of Aaron are going to be your priests and nobody else. The Levites are going to assist the sons of Aaron, the priests. And he laid everything out and said, this is the way it's going to be and nothing else. And they've grown up. They have a history of over 1,000 years, these people that the writer's writing to, of having this ceremonial law and following it. And now he's saying, it's now the former commandment. And he says, oh, and by the way, it's being replaced, and he uses those words that seem kind of harsh, it's weak and useless. Why does he say that? Well, in part because the Old Testament sacrifices in and of themselves didn't take away your sin, didn't make you right with God. They were just pointers to that. And the writer keeps making these comparisons and saying, all that was good. I mean, God gave it to you. But he did not intend the ceremonial law to be the final word about how you worship God or the final word about how God was going to make things right with you. No, that was preparation. The reality, the final, comes with Jesus. And one of the things in Hebrews, and we've talked about it through the last sermon or two, is that Jesus in Hebrews is presented as a priest like Melchizedek. Melchizedek was the king of Salem, now known as Jerusalem. He lived in the time of Abraham. And the writer says Jesus is not from the line of Aaron, not according to the ceremonial law. He's a priest like Melchizedek. Melchizedek wasn't from the line of Aaron because Aaron wasn't born yet. And through Jesus, we have a better hope. Jesus is the reality that all that Old Testament ceremonial law was pointing to. And he's making the case. The ceremonial law was designed to point to Jesus, and once Jesus came, you don't need it anymore. That's why the Christian said, we don't need the temple anymore. Because all those sacrifices with all the lambs and the bulls and the goats and all those animals, those were just pointers to the one sacrifice that got made when Jesus died. So then the writer makes another comparison in Hebrews 7. If you read the book of Hebrews, you'll see he continues to make comparisons, Jesus with various things. So in this case, he says, just as Melchizedek is greater than Abraham. And if you know the story, Abraham's nephew Lot was living close to Sodom and Gomorrah. Some kings came in, and they had their annual battle. Okay, seems like that's at that time that's what they did, because if I want more stuff, I'm going to go to your house and take your stuff. In that case, one kingdom would come to another, take their stuff. They kidnapped Lot and all the people of those cities, carried them away. Abraham chases after them, gets some of his friends, attacks them at night, gets everybody back. He's on his way back to where he lives in southern Canaan. And he passes by Salem. And Melchizedek, the king of Salem, comes out, but he's also a priest of God. And Melchizedek blesses Abraham. And the writer's point is, the greater person blesses the lesser person. And then Abraham gave a tenth of all he has as a gift to Melchizedek. The lesser person gives the gift to the greater person. So just as Melchizedek is greater than Abraham, Jesus is greater than the ceremonial law. And Jesus' covenant is greater than the covenant through Moses. Now, That might seem a little fuzzy to you, because again, he's writing to Jews who understood all of how these pieces worked. And in Hebrews 7:22, he says, this makes Jesus the guarantor of a better covenant. Now, you and I don't really know much about covenants, because we don't use them the way they did back then. A covenant is in the same family as an oath and a promise. It is a promise and a commitment between two people. And when I say it's a strong commitment, I mean strong, because in most covenants, you are promising to forfeit your life if you fail to keep the terms. So you don't just walk up and sign any old covenant for whatever it's asking you to do. You better think about it. Well, God, we've already read, the writer reminds everybody, God came to Abraham and he made promises. Then God confirmed those promises with an oath. And in Genesis 15, God comes to Abraham when Abraham is saying to God, okay, God, you've now promised me children. You just promised me the land I'm living in, and I'm a stranger here. I don't own anything. Can you help me out here? And God says, yes, we're going to make a covenant. I want you to know for sure that I'm going to give you everything that I've said. And so they made a covenant. And back then what they did when the two people made a covenant, they would take some animals, kill them, cut them in half, and lay the pieces out so that the blood came in between. And the two of them would go over and they would write out the terms of the covenant. Instead of just signing it, the two of them would get together and they would walk through the blood. And it was a visible picture. May this happen to me if I break the covenant. Except when you read Genesis 15, something very unusual happens. God has Abraham prepare all the animals, and he's standing to the side waiting to walk through, and God puts him to sleep. And only God goes through the blood. Only God goes through the animals. And what he's doing, I'm not getting ahead of myself. Just trying to keep track. What God did when he went through the blood, he said, all right, I'm going to keep my part of the bargain. I'm going to keep my part of the covenant. And so I'm putting my life on the line. If I fail to keep my part of the covenant, if I fail to keep the promises, if I fail to give you children and to make you into a nation, if I fail to bless you, if I fail to give your descendants this land, I sacrifice myself. But then, what is so unthinkable, because he was the only one who went through, is he's in effect saying to Abraham, okay, Abraham, you, and it becomes very clear that the covenant wasn't just to Abraham, but to his descendants, not just to his physical descendants, but to his spiritual descendants. Anybody else who believed, like Abraham, believed God's word, trusted God, the covenant was for us. And what God said was, if you fail, I die. You fail, I die. That's why Jesus had to die. Because he paid the price for our failure. Because all of us know, if we're honest with ourselves, we failed. Failed to love God, failed to love others. Well, later in Hebrews 7, the writer brings several thoughts together. And you might be wondering, I don't see how all these pieces fit. If you've heard all the other sermons, if you read through Hebrews up till now, you'll see that what he's doing is he's pulling a thread about priests, a thread about sacrifice, a thread about promises, a thread about covenant, a thread about the high priest, and he's weaving it into a tapestry that all fits. But it's, again, one of those things. You look at it, and you're hoping at some point it's going to click and you see that in this tapestry he's building, in all of these pieces, you see Jesus. So here's what he says. Hebrews 7:22-27. This makes Jesus the guarantor of a better covenant. The former priests were many in number because they were prevented by death from continuing in office. Just pause there for a second. God set up this ceremonial law. He said, all right, all the sons of Aaron are going to be, and their descendants are priests. And they're going to be mediators. When you come to the tabernacle or to the temple and offer a sacrifice, you bring it up and you only go so far. The priest takes it and offers it for you. But those priests died. And they died because in Genesis 2, God said, here's the consequence for disobeying, for turning away from God. It's death. Not just physical death, but being separated from God. Now, God uses the sacrifices, the ceremonial law, to say, to let us know He has an answer for our sin. He is going to take care of it, just like He's the only one who went through the blood with the covenant with Abraham. He's got an answer. He's going to show us. These priests died. But Jesus holds His priesthood permanently because He continues forever. He died, yes, but He rose again. He defeated death. He goes on to say, consequently, Jesus is able to save to the uttermost those who draw near to God through Him, since He always lives to make intercession for them. God is for us. Jesus is for us. Verse 26, it was indeed fitting that we should have such a high priest, holy, innocent, unstained, separated from sinners and exalted above the heavens. He has no need, like those high priests, to offer sacrifices daily. First for His own sins and then for those of the people, since He did this once for all when He offered up Himself. Jesus was compared to the priests, to the high priest. The writer is saying Jesus is the high priest. He's the perfect high priest. These other ones that were there, yes, they were obeying God by doing the things they did, but those other high priests, every day they had to offer sacrifice for their own sin because they, in their thoughts and in their words and actions, turned away from God. And on that day of atonement, that one day a year when they were allowed to go into the inner part of the tabernacle or the inner part of the temple to where the ark was and to sprinkle the blood as a picture of God covering and taking care of our sin, it was not only for the people outside the tent, but it was for themselves as well. And the writer says, but Jesus, He was perfect. He didn't have to make a sacrifice for His own failures because He didn't fail. And His sacrifice, His blood, His life was the perfect sacrifice. So it doesn't have to be repeated again. And that's what the promise and the oath and the covenant were all pointing to. When God said to Abraham, in you all the families of the earth will be blessed. It's pointing to Jesus. And Jesus' sacrifice as our substitute. Jesus' sacrifice that totally satisfies God's justice. Jesus being our high priest, our mediator. Let's come back to Hebrews 6 and let's wrap it up. In verse 17, God swore an oath to confirm His promise. And since there's nobody greater than God, He swore by His own name. And then the writer focuses not so much on the promises anymore, but now to the heirs of the promise. Who's the one that's going to benefit from this promise? Christians. People like you and me. And the writer goes on to say, we're given two unchangeable things, God's promise and His oath. God doesn't just speak the truth. He is truth. He cannot lie. So why did He make this formal promise? Why did He swear the oath? And why did He make the covenant? Well, one of the reasons He made the covenant was a picture for us to see, a little pointer ahead. But why did He make the promise and the oath? Not because he thought there was some question about His truthfulness. He wanted to encourage us. He wanted us to know it was absolutely sure. He wanted to know us to know that He's gonna, the hope that He talks about is certain. When He says that He loves us, it's now and forever. It's not if, it is. He does love us. When He talks about taking us to spend eternity with Him as our friend and our King, we don't have to wonder. We don't have to think, did I finally mess up? Did I actually just lose everything? Because I have been so selfish lately. No, we don't have to wonder and worry. And why do we need encouragement? Because you and I are still broken people in a broken world. And we get distracted, and we get discouraged, and we forget. And so God says, I want you to be absolutely sure that what I've promised I will do, I have done, I am doing, it's yours. You don't have to wonder at all. And he says, this is an anchor. Have you ever been in a ship out at sea and you want to stay in place? You put out an anchor. It holds you. And God holds us. And in verse 19, we're told, Jesus, our hope, entered the inner sanctuary. You see, when God had them build the tabernacle, and later when Solomon built the temple, and there was the holy place and the Holy of Holies, those were just copies. Those were copies of the real one in heaven. And when Jesus died, that's where he went as our high priest and our sacrifice. And that's where he went and entered there, and he offered himself so that it was complete. Now, I don't know about you, but to me, you got to think a bit and work at it to sort out what the writer of Hebrews is doing. He's bringing together all these pieces, and it might seem kind of complicated. But our summer Bible camp this week, and I just realized this as I finished and was wrapping up the sermon a couple days ago, summarizes this whole message very well. Here were the points that the children were taught. When you are lonely, when you worry, when you struggle, when you do wrong, you can hear them whispering. Okay, in just a second, I want you to say it. When you are lonely, when you worry, when you struggle, when you do wrong, when you are powerless, there it is. That's the message. That's the message of Hebrews. Whatever our need, Jesus rescues. He walks us through each day, each situation. He leaves us here for a time so that we, you and I, can be lights to other people, so that other people can see what it is to have a relationship with God. Not that we're perfect. Nobody can carry that kind of weight except God. But we're lights, and we're also the smell of life to other people. That's what he calls us to be. And he knows that we need reminders. He knows that we need encouragements. And so he gives us things like the Lord's Supper as a reminder of how much he loves us and that he did all that was required to satisfy God's justice, so that he could love us freely and we could love him back. If the elders would please come forward this morning.